Case number 21-3116, Melvin Brown, appellant versus Sandra Hill, et al. Mr. Rickman for the appellant, Ms. Browder for the district appellees, Ms. Eric Lauer for the summons.
Good morning. May it please the court, George Rickman on behalf of appellant Melvin Brown. This case originated because of wrongdoing by some, so others, i.e. an organization, a corporate in the District of Columbia, a contractor in the District of Columbia, mental health. It is alleged in a complaint that employees or others, i.e. made false statements about Mr. Brown concerning his conduct while housed the facility, along with illegally obtaining medical records to facilitate his removal and involuntary commitment to CPAC in the District of Columbia, to step up within the mental health system of the District of Columbia. This wrongdoing resulted in egregious harm to Mr. Brown, forced medication, and continued detention within the mental health system. For all intents and purposes, the U.S. District found that some was not a state actor for purposes of constitutional violations that resulted from these allegations. But the district court's premise in reaching its conclusion was based on custody. Custody is not a basis or defining public function within state action, or is defined by state action. Referring to West versus Act.
Before we kind of go along with some of your more substantive arguments, I mean, you realize the case has been pending since December 2013, and kind of the third dismissal from this court. So what's the best argument you would say that with respect to any equitable tolling or relation back?
Well, looking at 15C, the landscape has changed since this court's opinion and Nassim Rindl-Paker and Rindl-Speranza versus Nassim and Krupski versus Costa-Pierre. Two important factors occurred in Krupski. Krupski first altered the analysis from to requiring or considering what a possible defendant knew or should have known within the tolling period. Nassim explicitly rejected that argument. We look at the A and B analysis, where Krupski says, well, if A was mistaken about B's role, or the plaintiff was mistaken between A and B's role, that would be a mistake. Nassim itself rejected that, finding that that was not a mistake. So that underlying premise certainly changed with the opinion of Krupski.
But the argument was that he was looking for his medical records, and then, you know, something prompted how he got them, but there was such a delay even then in getting the medical records. And then you also sued Somm, but not necessarily identifying specifically in the complaint in what capacity, whether it was going to be official or individual as well.
Well, this has been longstanding precedent in this court, that you look at the progress of the litigation in determining whether a particular capacity of a defendant. I think that if you look at the complaint itself, Somm is named as a particular defendant within the text of particular counts within the complaint. The course of events that are alleged makes it clear that Gerlach and Don Adams, the president and CEO of Somm, were sued in their official.
Okay.
In fact, I think that's in the footnote within the brief.
And that's kind of the default anyway, if you don't sue them individually, specifically alleging certain actions against them, then they would default to official capacity.
Yeah, anyway. Actually, it would probably be an easier case to prove against Gerlach and Adams. Because even Well, assuming that some is found to be a state actor, state actor was not official capacity was not under 1983 as being persons under 1983. But that being said, while some did not raise the defense of Monell offenses, it certainly may be available. So it would probably be an easier case to prove. But some, but that being said, I think we argued that Pembauer, that Pembauer would apply because it had actual knowledge of what was going on. And there may have been particular allegations that they in some way participated in the wrongdoing. So that in itself would also the purposes of identifying some of but going back to your question about this, while this case offers John Doe defendants and Kupski, apparently the defendants were known to the plaintiff. There's a split in the circuit as to whether or not Kupski altered the landscape to include John Doe defendants. Because the and arguably because the reasoning of Kupski lends itself to the understanding that the knowledge or the knowledge shifts to the what the defendant knew should have known. What's the different context within you consider John Doe defendant? And there are also particular interests, policy interests that involve there. That there will be particularly in that involving where one kind of who perhaps knew of the defendant would be able to avail themselves of 15C, while a defendant who did not know that the name of the defendant, though is still intended to sue that defendant, if they did know, would be not be able to avail themselves of 15C. And that particular inequity would be addressed by permitting John Doe defendants to be included within 15C. No, also bad regarding 15C. In the district's brief, they argued that there was no timely notice, but that was based on the actual filing of the complaint. Under 4M, actual summonses were not sent out until sometime in 1-7-2015. Therefore, there would be inferred notice under the theory articulated in a single term as to some defendants who were within that 100-day. I just want to make that point. And returning back to state action, the court's basic theory on state action that there was not traditional or exclusive function involving the providing of mental health services within the district. But it's been a long-standing and traditional mandate requirement that the district provide these particular services. It's defined in the statute, it's defined by case law. And I think we pointed to the Dixon consent decree that was entered that can order the district to provide particular housing services. And in light of that, the mandatory requirements, the court did not address in the first particular obligations that were presented or provided the basis for state action. I tried to reserve 5 minutes for the follow-up.
Okay, thank you. See?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Megan Browder on behalf of Dr. Amelia Villaruz, David Walker, and the District of Columbia, whom I'll refer to collectively as the District Appellees. Because it is undisputed that none of the District Appellees were a party to this litigation before the end of the statute of limitations period, Mr. Brown must show his entitlement to equitable tolling or that Rule 15 applies. He can do neither. First, as to equitable tolling, there's no diligence. The only thing Mr. Brown relies on in the record is his superior court suit, but he did not file that suit until June 2014, which was already outside the statute of limitations period. Also, he received the medical records from that suit within at most 2 months. So if he had actually diligently pursued that and filed that suit within the statute of limitations period, he would have gotten those records. Second, as to extraordinary circumstances, he's waived that by not raising it below or before this court. And there's also nothing in the record to support any extraordinary circumstances. Second, as to Rule 15 does not apply here in this court. I know that appellant relies on Krupski, but I don't think it's necessary to go into the mistake doctrine at all to solve this case. This court can resolve it on the first prong of Rule 15C, which says that the defendant had to have notice within the Rule 4M period of the act and had to receive such notice. It's undisputed that no district appellee received notice of this action before June 2015 when Mr. Walker was served. That's more than a year after the statute of limitations period ended. And even on the second prong, even if we set aside the mistake part of it, the defendant also had to know within the 4M period that they would have been an intended defendant here. And again, because the district did not receive such notice, none of the district appellees would have been on notice or would have been able to know within the 4M period. There are no questions. We would rest on our papers and ask that this court affirm the district court's dismissal of all of the district appellees.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. Kate R. Clower on behalf of Somm, Ann Chauvin, Belinda Seeley, Susan Bond, John Adams, and Richard Gerlich, will refer to as the Somm appellees. The court inquired as to the circuit's position on that dismissal of Somm as an entity was appropriate. And here we would request that the court affirm because it was appropriate to dismiss Somm because they were never named as a defendant in the litigation. Through the 4 amended complaints. There was never issue of a summons or service on Somm as a party, and therefore it was appropriate to dismiss Somm in its corporate capacity as it was never named or served with process. On the issue of state action, the fact that Somm, which is a housing provider that provides services under a contract with the Department of Behavioral Health, provided housing to Mr. Brown is not sufficient to establish that it was a state act. The fact that the District of Columbia provides housing to individuals who receive mental health care is not sufficient to establish that any of these Somm employees were in fact state actors. All of the cases that are cited by Mr. Brown are distinguishable because in those cases, not only was the state providing mental health services through its contractors, but in each of those cases, the plaintiff was in the custody and care specifically of the state. That fact is not present here, and therefore there are no facts that are sufficient to establish that Somm was a state actor for the purposes of 1983.
And do you contest then the appellant's suggestion that this is a mandated service by the state?
I do, Your Honor. I mean, there is a requirement that the Department of Mental Health provides services to people who are eligible and apply for such services, but there are many people in the District of Columbia who need and have mental health care, but they're not remanded to the custody of the District of Columbia. So that makes it distinguishable, because although the Department of Mental Health is established to provide those services, it's not a requirement that everyone who is eligible go then into the custody of the district.
When was it established?
I'm sorry?
When was it established?
I'm sorry, the Department of Behavioral Health. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
I think the standard here involves to a degree whether something has historically been a function solely of the state.
That's correct.
Which is not at all the case.
That's correct. If there are no other questions, we're happy to rest on our papers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've allotted 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Crystal, Judge
Ginsburg. I'm going to have to bring the mic up so I can hear you, please.
First, to address Judge Ginsburg's concerns that this is not historical within the district of the Division of Mental Health Services or housing for mental health services. Dixon versus the Dixon consent decree is more than 20 to 30 years old. This followed the Irvin Act, which required that the district, or mandated that the district provide housing services for a particular class of persons. This is more analogous to West versus Act, where the obligation was for a particular class of persons, that being prisoners within the system. Plus, it was not the dispositive factor. What was dispositive was the obligation that was established within a long-standing principle of the district, within particular the District of Columbia. It's been long since more than 20, 30 years. This is quite different from Wendell Baker versus Cohen, where the Supreme Court kind of looked at.
Are there not other institutions that perform this function, non-public institutions?
There are none.
There are. But it's unlike a prison.
Well, the non-public prisons that provide functions, but they're private operating prisons that perform the same functions as state actors. They're state actors as well. So I don't think that that point that there are other non-public institutions that provide this service. In fact, some is a non-public institution, but they're providing it within the mandates of the District of Columbia. And it's the obligation that establishes the state action. That's the premise of West versus Atkins. And that is the premise that, well, that particularly was not addressed within Halleck. Halleck in the footnote specifically reserved on West versus Atkins and whether or not did not address the obligation theory of state action. I think that is very present within the district of in the history of Hispanic system. It's very defined, it's an obligation to define class. I think the consent decree recognized that there may be other mental health persons who would not be fit within the system because of sheer numbers, but that's still required, a mandate that a particular number of beds be provided within the mental health system of the District of Columbia. And to go further to back to address Rule 15 or the equitable tolling addressed by district defendant. They claim that there was 14 months, some period of time from the filing of the complaint before or when Mr. Brown obtained the information through the lawsuit. That this case was on appeal, so he could not have filed information until the court set a time in order to file the second amendment. So that argument kind of begs the question: is like, if he can't do it, then how could that not or be held against him showing diligence? And the 15C. I just like to restate the interest of perhaps particularly with John Doe, that the inequities involved and between persons who would know, persons who would not be, that though in all of the concerns would be in the same position with regards to ability to go to sleep. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted.